Coming up next is the show you've been waiting for, Black Op Radio. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network. Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. To call in, we have a secure line ready. Area code 604-525-4167. Again, just call area code 604-525-4167. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. And now your hosts, Anita Langley and Leno Sanik.
This is Black Op Radio.
This is Black Op Radio number 171, May 13th, 2004. And we are joined on the line here by Judith Very Baker. And she has some very interesting history to fill us in on from her perspective. We'd really like to hear about this. Are you able to hear me better now?
Yes, I can.
Great. Okay, we've got our mics up and running. So, Judith, perhaps you could just start us off by giving us some background for those listeners who might not be familiar with your story, although I think probably most of our listeners are. How would you like to just fill us in from the beginning?
Well, I think it'd be better if you asked a question, because I was injured in Dallas. It was a stupid place to go, I guess, to try and get evidence. And I'd do better if you would respond to questions. I've had two brain concussions.
Okay. No problem. Oh, no problem. We often like just to ask people to give some so that people can be familiar a little bit with who you are.
Okay.
But whatever makes you comfortable, no problem. So let's then just start, maybe step back. You knew Lee Harvey Oswald. And this is something that, of course, to the JFK research community is a very big thing, because for so many years, people have been researching this, and there's been no sign to
anyone who really
would
hang out with them.
Nobody who, yeah, and
well, I can understand why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perhaps I could go into some detail. First of all, after Lee was killed, after Kennedy was murdered, I plucked my eyebrows. I pulled my hair back, let it grow so I could sit on it. It got so long. I changed the way I walked and talked to everything. I started putting down my height as 5'3 instead of 5'2, and so on. I had actually posed as Marina Oswald in New Orleans, and it was because of convenience. Marina was kept at home and out of circulation pretty much. Well, she went to Pontchartrain Beach and a few places where there are a lot of people. But you see, I had studied Russian. Lee and I met on Friday, April 26, 1963, and we hit it off right away. I still look back on those days. It was just, if you had known the man I had known, you would know that there is no possible way, if you knew what he thought of Kennedy, that he could have possibly pulled the trigger. It was like we called ourselves Boris and Natasha, because we did start having an affair, and we didn't want anyone to know. And because of that, since I was the same height as Marina, I weighed the same, I had the same figure, I had the same blue eyes, I even had the same haircuts, even in the past, and past photos at the same time. It was a remarkable coincidence, and it served our purposes. When we met, we would meet separately, and when we left, like a hotel, we'd leave separately.
With Judith?
Yes.
Before that, why don't you go into the background, like how did you first meet Lee?
What? Well, I'm not sure now that it was an accident. At the time, I thought it was. it's a long story. Originally, I'd come to New Orleans. I was trying to lure my future husband to come. I really had learned what the opposite sex was all about, and it was wonderful. And I thought I was in love with Robert Baker. And, in fact, in a certain way I was. There are different kinds of love. I've learned that. But anyway, I lured him to New Orleans because I had for some time been engaged in cancer research, even though I was quite young. And I had started actually in cancer research when I was only 14 years old. My grandparents, both of them died of cancer. I could go on and on. My Aunt Elsie, it meant so much to me, was cured of cancer. It was a goal of mine, and I had run across them. I had actually created a line of cancerous fish. And to make a long story short, I gave lung cancer using a cigarette extract faster than it had ever been done before. But I had a lot of help. I had doctors who were trained at Oak Ridge, and many, many people were interested in what I was doing. I felt like I was getting on the fast track in cancer research because of Sputnik. Sputnik had changed everybody's attitude about training America's young scientists more rapidly. So even though I was a female, I had scored very high on IQ tests in Florida, and I was selected among a number of other students in Florida to receive special training, including speaking Russian. I can't do it anymore. I turned away from all of that after the assassination. But I have all the records. I have, there's no doubt who I was and what I did, and all that will be profusely illustrated in my upcoming book.
Now, speaking of books, we've had a chance to discuss, and you told me a few things about your first book that I think it'd be rather important to let the public know that you're not very happy with the way the first book came out.
Well, there are a number of factors for that. First of all, I didn't want to, I was really paranoid about writing all this down to begin with. I was terrified. I looked up all my old friends. They all had been, conveniently, were dead. I was scared. And so I wrote a bunch of nonsense because I didn't want to get sued. All I wanted to do was to get some publishers interested in my story, and then I would give them the other book, which, by the way, a number of people saw my original book. It's not what was put out there to begin with. That was, I guess you might call it a teaser. I put it out there in order to try and get interest. I wanted to see what would happen. I wanted to see how I would fare, if anybody would even listen to me. I had no hope, really, that I would be listened to until, after JFK, the film came out, I didn't even know about this records review board. Someone told me about it, and then I finally realized that they did know, finally, that, for example, that the Mafia and the CIA had worked together in anti-Castro projects to assassinate Castro. I had no idea that any of that had come out because I avoided all of that material. And even looking at it, I'm told I had a psychological reaction because I saw my Lee shot on TV. And I honestly remember screaming, and I can't even remember what happened after that. And from then on, I refused to look at any of it. I was afraid I would give it up. That is my information. And I was afraid I would die, and I knew if I could stay alive somehow, I could write it all down. And I did write a great book, and I was going to give it to my son, who's a professor of political science. After I died, he would get the book, and it would have everything in it. But JFK, the film, changed my mind because it said, "You're a coward if you didn't speak up," and I'm not a coward. I just didn't think anyone would ever believe me.
Well, and in all fairness, there is so much bad information out there about John Kennedy that with this kind of thing, people really do want to see proof.
I got it.
Yeah, and I understand it. You've sent me some interesting clips that I wish I had time to discuss with you, possibly. I don't know if you have them all on a website, but I found particularly interesting a newspaper clipping that you sent me that had your name on it as a youngster hosting a party.
Yes. Yes, I was fiercely anti-Castro. I dated Tony Lopez Frisquet, who was the son of the finance minister of Cuba under Castro. And the boys had been sent to the United States because their mother was American, and they were afraid that that would hurt the boys. So they were sent there. And during the Bay of Pigs and then the Cuban Missile Crisis and everything, Tony had friends who were tortured by Castro. And he tortured himself at one point to see by using a Bunsen burner under his arm to see what it felt like, because that happened to one of his friends who was associated with the CIA. And because of the influences of these people, I was far more willing than maybe some others would be to be interested in eliminating one man rather than seeing him aim nuclear weapons that could kill 40 million people. So I felt quite motivated to do something. I thought I would, I do have witnesses, living witnesses. Now, some of them have been threatened, and they were not in the television documentary, The Love Affair, to protect them. And, of course, by revealing them, they have, these people have received threats. They have been intimidated, and I would like to play just briefly a small clip for you from a film that was made with six witnesses. And this lady did not know she was going to be filmed. It was a spontaneous thing. We didn't have any cameras. One lady who came had a camera, and she said, can I please get a testimony from you, and would you like to hear it?
Sure, if you've got it ready.
Sure, I have it ready. Just a second, and I'll play it for you.
Okay.
Okay, here we go.
Baker and I and James and me would walk the streets of New Orleans. It was walking and talking. We used to go to the old Preservation Hall, listen to jazz music together.
Can you hear that?
It's a little difficult. We've got it turned up.
One night, Lee Harvey Oswald, while I was at work, his wife called the place and asked me if her husband was in there.
Could you hear any of that?
Yeah, I could hear the last part best.
Okay, well, I'm going to keep it going here. And here, listen.
Not long after, his wife walked in. She says, I know he was in here. I said, oh, well, I don't know who your husband is, lady, to begin with. So we go to the 500 Club, and that we met there. There was me, Judy, David. Me, we met with Carlos Marcellus and Jack Ruby. And if you ever been to the 500 Club, when you walk through the door, and it's just to let you know that I've been there, the bar is to your right. You walk in, and then you turn to your right, and you look straight up, and there was Carlos Marcellus' office. And he had a two-way mirror up there, which he watched the people make sure they didn't steal from it. Carlos Marcellus was a very nice, distinguished-looking gentleman.
And she talks about here how he liked her and all that. Were you able to hear that? Because I don't want to waste your time.
Yeah, no, we could hear that.
All right, the lady who's talking, and I'll put it back on in just a second. Her name is Anna Lewis. She is the wife of David Lewis. Now, David Lewis at one point was shot at, but he tried to pretend it was somebody that everybody knew who had shot at him, and he didn't pass a lie detector test. And so because of that, they say that Anna Lewis is no... Oh, here we go. Listen.
And Judy's a little stuck-up girl. She thought she was better than anybody else, and she hung on to Lee Harvey Oswald's arm like she thought that I wanted to steal it from her. Lee Harvey Oswald was a very possessive man. When he told Judy to jump, she better act to die high. He also was a very quiet man. He definitely did not look like a man that was going to assassinate anyone. He was, like I said, quiet. He listened to what other people had to say, but never commented on anything. When he spoke, you had better listen to what he had to say. Like Judy was, he does not like to have somebody talk when he's talking.
Now, she's going to say one more thing here, and then I'll cut it off.
To tell you the truth, he was not my type. Even though I don't think David Lewis was my type either, but I found that out later. David, give
me a description
of David Lewis.
All right, and then she goes on. We don't have enough time, but anyway, at one point, I think you can hear that she said that Lee and I were dating and with them and went different places. And another spot on this tape, and I'm going to turn this off, she says that I was his mistress, and I was just very embarrassed when she said that right in front of all these people. It's not something that's been easy for me to talk about over the years. This is not the only witness I have. I have a number of them. A number of them who wouldn't go on tape, and some who did, or on film.
Now, who made the tape?
Deborah Conway made the tape. The reason I'm laughing is because Deborah Conway, I can't say all the things that have happened since, but let's say that Deborah and David Lifton have worked very closely together on a book called Charade, Story of Lee Oswald's Life, and when publishers knew this book that I had was coming out, and there wasn't any mention of our love affair or anything in that. I mean, David's book was Deep Six. Now, it may come out later. But as a matter of fact, I also had a relationship with Mary Farrell, and I tried hard to get her to change her will, where she wanted to leave a great deal of money to JFK Lancer that's run by Deborah Conway. To make a long story short, even though she made this film and it was supposed to be for me, and it was she actually took a copy herself, and I could go into a lot of detail about this, but 60 Minutes got a copy of it and sent it to me because they knew it belonged to me. I really don't want to go into any more detail about that except to say that since the film was made, this poor lady has been intimidated, threatened. She lost her job for a year after making the film. And she has a young son who had half his brain removed from brain cancer, and she was called and told that if she allowed this film to be in the documentary, The Love Affair, only she didn't know what it was going to be called at that time. Nobody did. But if the film was ever to come out, that the state would take her child or her brain-damaged son away from her. And so she said, Judith, please don't. So we have not done this. We have not produced the entire tape or shown it to anybody except people who come to see me. I have tapes, video of a number of people who, and emails of people who know, especially who were mafia-related, who knew about Lee and me.
Now, Marina, did she suspect or did she know? Was there any hint there?
Well,
there might have been.
All through the book, Marina and Lee are the most ironic things mentioned. For example, Lee, for the only time in their whole marriage, didn't refuse to tell her where he was working. Now, that was because Lee and I were working at the same place. Lee and I fell in love. I have all the documents to prove that we were interviewed the same day by Mr. Prechter, that we were hired the same day, and I'm the only person you will find in history, with wherever Lee went to work, who can claim and prove they were hired the same day as Lee Oswald for any company. On top of that, that's just one little coincidence, but on July 19th, when he was fired, for example, on July 20th, out comes an ad. I think I sent that to you. The ad is to replace me. I was the executive secretary for William I. Monahan, former FBI agent and former security officer for Standard Fruit. He was also a charter member of INCA, the Information Council of the Americas, that was started by Edward Butler and Dr. Alton Oxner, who is, of course, my mentor. Now, why in the world would I come to New Orleans with my cancer research background to be hired as a secretary to a vice president when I couldn't even hardly type? But I was there for a very special reason. In the afternoons, in that position, I was able to leave many 3 afternoons a week. Supposedly, I was out helping Monahan find information about, because as vice president, he was the head of the finance and credit checks for all the business that Riley Coffee and Tea Company did, in charge of all their, salesman would go out and go ahead and sell coffee, a coffee contract to a new company. And I was supposed to do the credit checks on the companies, or if we had a new salesman to hire, or any new hire. We went to retail credit, or I went over there, and would order for Standard Coffee Company or for Riley, I would order the background and credit checks, the financial and character background checks. Well, in this position, I was able to create a fabricated background and character check for Lee Oswald. He never would have passed, of course, if they had simply ordered retail credit to look into his background. We're talking about a young man who is a returned defector. It was in all the newspapers. He's married to a Russian-speaking woman. Rileys were so conservative. They were also charter members of INCA. And William Riley, according to Jerry Hemming, had been working for the CIA for years. And I've got all the documents for all of that kind of thing. To make a long story short, the business that I had, it was that I had a way to work on a cancer research project that was clandestine, that we were involved. It was an accident that I got on that side, and it was due to being able to, my meeting Lee Oswald, while Ochsner was out of town, what happened is that I dropped the right names. I was going to marry Robert A. Baker, and I was writing to Robert Baker, and we were going to elope, so he asked me not to use my name so his parents wouldn't notice a girl was writing to him, a girl they knew he was pretty fond of. So instead, I had put a little ad in the paper, said Jar-yo to Jar-ya, that I had arrived. It was code under personals, and he knew that I had arrived safely in New Orleans with that. And, of course, I have the originals of all these things, the original envelopes where I wrote all that down and the ads and everything. Well, I saved everything because of who Lee was and how we got involved. So I was supposed to write as if I were a Mr. Rourke, Rally Rourke, a friend of Robert Baker's. Well, when I was at the post office, I asked if any letter had come from Mr. Rourke, that I was there to pick up a letter from Mr. Rourke from Robert A. Baker at Eglin Air Force Base, because Robert was sending me mail from Fort Walton Beach or from Eglin, depending on where he was, because his father was building some housing out at near Eglin at Hurlbut Arms. So Lee heard this, and he knew there was a secret agent, Robert A. Baker, in Florida, who at that time was working with Alexander Rourke. Rourke was a contract pilot with the CIA, and later he would be murdered. He was a friend of Lee's. Well, I didn't know any of that, but Lee did. And when I dropped those names, and when he saw that ad in the paper, and when he realized that I could speak some Russian, and on top of that, I said I was there to work on a project with Dr. Mary Sherman. Now, Dr. Sherman was working for Dr. Ochsner, and I was supposed to be in on this project, but unwittingly. Accidentally, because Ochsner was out of town, I had come 2 weeks early to New Orleans. Ochsner was out of town, and even Mary Sherman was briefly out of town at some kind of meeting. But Lee had dined. He had come in on the 25th, the day before, and Lee had dined with David Ferry. Dave Ferry was working with Mary Sherman on this project. Now, Edward Haslam has gone a great deal. It's amazing how much information he found about Dave Ferry's activities. And he happens to also be a native of New Orleans, and I was able to talk to him, and he would ask me questions about that whole area. And he'd been inside Dave Ferry's apartment. Anyway, I was able to describe everything to him inside. They haven't changed all these years, the interior of Dave's apartment. And because he had grown up in that area, he knew things like about a service road that used to exist that isn't there anymore, that I used to come and go from to approach Dave's apartment from the back. And there are other things like that that they're just not there anymore, you know. And he knew about that most people never did, and there was no way to know about it unless you lived in that area. Well, at any rate, she was out of town, but Lee thought I was the help that had been promised that was supposed to help Dave. Someone else was going to be brought in, and that I was the help that was going to help him at Riley. And, of course, none of that turned out to be the case. It was an accident. I was going to be brought in on the other side of it. I was going to be at Ochsner's clinic. But when I met Dave Ferry and we started talking all that, first of all, we're both Catholics. He wanted to be a priest. I wanted to be a nun. We really hit it off. He's supposed to have been a misogynist, but actually he just thought most women were stupid, and he hadn't met enough bright ladies in his life. It was fascinating. The man was fascinating. I say is all the time. It's hard for my mind to realize that these men, Lee and Dave, Mary, have all dead. Didn't survive any of this. And my mind doesn't like to accept any of that. It's very difficult because we became very close. But anyway, so when I met Lee at the post office, he thought I was one of the helpers that was going to help Dave on the other side. By the time Oxner got back in town and I'd met Mary Sherman, it was too late. I knew about the anti-Castro aspect of the project. And so they said, why don't you go ahead and help Lee? They were originally going to use two women, hire two ladies, one for the afternoon and one for the morning, so that they wouldn't be able to correlate or understand what Lee was doing. And Monahan was going to cover for Lee, but with me in place there, I was used. Now, how did I cover for Lee? Lee Oswald, it's on the record in the Warren Commission that Lee Oswald had a work break at 9 o'clock in the morning. And Mr. Barbie, Emmett Barbie, talks about that. He was his supervisor. And he said that Lee would often overstay his work break in the morning. They also had one at 1:30 in the afternoon. But, my dears, when you go and look at Lee's work record for Riley, you'll see that 10 times he came in so late he wasn't even there for the 9 o'clock work break. Furthermore, he was only on time one time out of 49 times. That was his first day of work at Riley. The other times he was always late. That is, he was supposed to be there by 8 o'clock. If you count that he was supposed to be there at 8:30, which is absurd if you think that, why would you have a break at 9 o'clock? Because, of course, I can't prove that he had to be there at 8 o'clock, except that I had to be there at 8 o'clock. But what I can show is that Lee Oswald was still late 70% of the time, even if you count that he was supposed to be there by 8:30. Now, on the other end of it, even though Lee Oswald is clocking in at, I could go to all the records, but it's like 9:32, 10:40 or something, 8:31. He's all over the place, okay? All kinds of strange clock-ins. Most of the time he had a meeting to go to before he came into Riley. Now, he was supposed to be hired at $1.50 an hour. And that was an hourly rate. If he had been actually given the hourly rate, he wouldn't have very much money because they also docked you. And in fact, my check show, I have check stubs, of course, that I kept. When I was late for 5 minutes, I was docked 20 cents. Imagine what would happen to him and his paycheck. But no, most of the time he has $52.72 or whatever. Anyway, you can see it all down the line. It only varies when they have to take on insurance and once they gave him an extra hour credit for overtime. Now, why am I mentioning this? Because Lee wasn't there to clock himself out most time. Most of the time, he wasn't. So even though he had these very erratic clock-ins on one end, I was responsible for clocking him out on the other because you could never guess where he might be. And so on the other end, even though the first end you have, it's all over the place, all over the clock, on the other side, you have 4:30, like 10 times, I don't know how, I don't have the record in front of me, but like maybe 15 times in a row it said 5 o'clock or 5:30, right on the nose. Now we're talking about 72 employees that were there at Riley that I knew about at that time, and they had to stand in line to clock out. Now, if they were clocking out at 4:30 or 5 or whatever, when you look at their records, they were clocking out like 5:03, 5:01, always after 5 or after 4:30 if they were on the 4:30 shift, 4:36, 4:34, 4, you know what I'm saying. But these are all right on the nose, 5:30, 5:30, 5:30, right in a row. The reason is I was the executive secretary, and I just walked there and got in the line. They deferred to me, grabbed his card, slipped it in, clocked him out, and clocked myself out because I didn't want to stay there any longer than I had to. Even when I left the premises, I had to be back to clock him out. And that was part of what I did. And in this way, we covered for him in many other ways also. Once, when there was a complaint because he didn't show up for oiling, we said that he was down, for example, at the new plant. They were making an instant coffee plant and that he was working as an oiler on a crane. I mean, so we had to make up these excuses when he didn't show up for quite a while, well, maybe most of the day. To kind of prove that what I'm talking about is correct, there is one clock out on the other end of 7:32 p.m. at night. Now, I don't know how many employees you know would actually stay that late, but what happened is I am an absent-minded professor, and one time I forgot to clock him out at all, and we had to go back and clock him in. Now, also you'll find out, if you look carefully, that at the Texas State School Book Depository. Very interesting record that Lee Oswald on the 22nd of November is shown as having clocked out at 5 o'clock. Now, who did that for him? I know if I had been, if he had been at Riley, it would have been me. It certainly wasn't Lee. He was already arrested at that time. Just for information. Oh, I've got lots of records.
Oh, that's interesting. So you've actually got that record, or that's, I haven't heard that one before.
I certainly do. That's
very interesting.
I have tons of records, and they are in the book. As to the project and the legitimacy of the project, I would like to read you something. I hope this isn't boring you guys.
No, I just wanted to ask you a question about the timetable.
Yeah.
So what you're implying is that you...
I'm stating, sir. I'm not implying. I'm stating.
No, but you're stating, yeah. But still, on the other side of the world here, that doesn't mean, you know,
yeah.
I can't see anything. So I'm saying that I was about to say, you're implying that Lee Oswald's timekeeping was handled, you know, okay, and stating, mm-hmm. regardless, by you or other
Absolutely.
People. And so then, by that, what are you implying, that he had other duties that were not known about?
Oh, absolutely. He was only a block away from Bannister's office. He was only two blocks away from ONI. You're talking about FBI, CIA. When he was over at supposedly reading gun magazines, which were basically Field and Stream, and they did have some American Rifleman and things like that over at Adrian Albus, that's where he would meet people. This is where their cars were kept for all these people. And he made friends with Adrian and the other Elvis who ran the garage there, not just because he was lazy, but because he used the garage actually to leave the premises. When he went through Elvis, you could not see him go out. I've got all the photos to prove it. If he left through the front of Elvis' garage, you couldn't see him from Riley's leave. So he made friends over there, and then he would just walk through anytime he wanted to. But in the morning, he wouldn't even show up. I mean, he went to meetings in the morning. He didn't even show up at Riley's until
okay.
he missed, as I say, he missed 10 times even his first work break.
All right, so what do you think then what he was doing when he should have been at the Riley Company and that...
Most mornings, I know that on many mornings, I won't say most, I do not know what he was doing, but I know on several occasions that he went over to Guy Bannister's. And early... May and so on, you have Michael L. Kurtz, who is a professor of history at Louisiana University, and he says himself, and I could quote it for you, but twice he and a friend of his saw Guy Bannister with Lee Oswald at various colleges, at a college campus, and actually Lee went to several of them. And what they were doing were trying to ferret out your SDS and your radical students. The students would soon be leaving at the end of the semester, which would be, in May. They would be leaving, and some of them Bannister considered rabble-rousers who would be in the civil rights movement, who would be causing trouble. He wanted to, and Lee's, it was an onerous, disgusting job for Lee, because he was actually secretly a very liberal person about segregation and all that, but unfortunately Bannister was not, and one of his most onerous duties was to assist Bannister, because Bannister couldn't go on campus by himself. He looked all the way FBI. He had to have a young man with him who would give him the entree to some of these student groups, and Lee functioned in that and capacity and was seen by Dr. Kurtz, and others as well.
So, Judith, have you ever seen Lee and Bannister together?
Yes, I was introduced once to Guy Bannister. What happened is that there was an awful party that Dr. Sherman went to, but she wouldn't speak to me, and later I found out it's because she didn't want people seeing me speaking to her because of the project, but I didn't know at that time, and it hurt my feelings that she didn't talk to me, and here, and the party itself deteriorated into a homosexual thing, and I left, and Lee took me home. But the point is that at that time I saw things that made it hard for me to believe that these were the great, you know, guys committed to trying to get Castro, their CIA and all that. What I saw was, well, it was shocking to me because of who I was only 19 years old at the time when I saw this behavior, and I was shocked. So the problem they had is they had to prove to me who they were. And Excuse me, I have a short-term memory problem, because so you're going to have to repeat to me.
Yeah,
what
well,
you
I'll just
asked.
Ask you when you saw Lee and Guy Bannister together.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Well, I wanted proof of who that these people were legitimate. It was just too much. The behavior, the flagrant stuff I saw. And so Lee set it up so I could meet Guy Bannister. And this is before we started at Riley's. I had not consented yet to doing something like this at Riley's. I wanted to work with Dr. Ochsner in the clinic, and I was supposed to get an internship to do that, and then I would enter Tulane Medical School in the fall, and that was my plan. And if Robert Baker had just one semester to go, and he could then, if we got married and he went back, he just had one semester to go, and then he could join me, and I would be headed for my degree to get and then to become a doctor, and that was what I wanted to do. Well, anyway, so I wanted to, Lee said, I will prove to you who I am and who Dave is and everything. So he had me dress a certain way and put my hair a certain way and told me just to speak Russian and keep my eyes down. Don't smile showing my teeth, because Marina didn't. And he introduced me, by the way, Delphine Roberts and her daughter, Roberts Delphine Jr., were there, and one other person, a male, was there in the office to the left. We went to the right. Guy Bannister knew who I was, but, of course, didn't let on to them. I posed as Marina Oswald, and the poor Delphine Roberts, later when she said, yes, I met Mrs. Oswald, they thought it meant his mother, because she said she was lovely. And, of course, Mrs. Oswald was past her prime. I did look just like Marina, and it was exciting to me to try to pass myself off like that, and I did so successfully. Well, when I walked in and saw what Guy Bannister had there and how he treated Lee, then I knew. And so, I mean, to me it was exciting. It was an adventure. I felt like I was helping my country.
So at that point, you were able to get past some of the other stuff and just focus on your work.
Yeah, well, Dave Ferry had to promise not to swear in my presence and to warn me if someone was coming over, I would leave. And we worked out a compromise. He was always a gentleman in my presence from then on.
Now, did you feel as though there was a close friendship between Lee and Ferry, or how would you describe the relationship?
Oh, absolutely. However, it had a rocky start. Unfortunately for Lee, Dave Ferry was not very diplomatic, shall we say, in handling of young boys, and he's, of course, become notorious. But in my opinion, it's been overblown, although, of course, I was his friend, so I'm prejudiced, I suppose. But there's no doubt that Dave Ferry made a pass at Lee Oswald, and Lee did rebuke it and reject it. And Lee had seen a lot. He had grown up in New Orleans, so he knew. He knew what Dave was trying to do, and he also knew how to fight. And Dave ended up respecting Lee, but he loosened his tooth. Now, I'm going to say something that's going to make the two Oswald people really mad. And, in fact, when I've told them various things like this, and I put them on a website over at JFK Research, Mr. De La Rosa erased everything. He said it wasn't even worth archiving. So, you know. But the fact is that they don't like to hear these things because it messes up their two Oswald theory. Even though we're talking about Lee Oswald's fingerprints match Harvey Oswald's fingerprints in Dallas, and I could go on and on about that and about handwriting samples. Well, here's what I could tell you about this. They've smacked him in the mouth pretty hard and beat him. And he really got angry because Lee was taunting him and everything, and, you know, and resisting. And then he realized that Lee's mother was dating Sam Termine. He was at one time had been the driver for Carlos Marcello. And then he remembered that Lee's uncle was a boxer and was really lovely. And Dave Ferry was in big trouble. He had blood coming out of Lee's mouth and everything. The tooth was very loose. He was afraid it'd come out. He told Lee to be sure and get milk if it came out. He gave him $20 so he could go to a dentist if it came out. Well, it wasn't a week later, so when he got smacked in the mouth really hard by a football player who was a friend of some kid that Lee had had a fight with or something at school. Anyway, there's this famous picture of Lee Oswald with no tooth. Now, we're talking about a teenager. Now, I'm going to tell you, if your tooth fell out, would you leave it on the ground and just and so that the two Oswald people who say, look, one Lee has, you know, one of them has a tooth out and the other one doesn't. Well, just like any teenager who wants to save his front tooth, Lee saved his tooth, put it in milk, went to the dentist, had it pushed in and sewed in, and it took. It was not lost. They don't like to hear that. Now, there is some slight proof of this in that the skull of Lee Oswald, when they exhumed the body, the dental record that matched there shows that tooth number 9, that's that front tooth there, is rotated. That means it's not straight like you would expect it to have been, because in earlier pictures you can see Lee's both teeth are straight. It's rotated. And it's right there in the dental record, rotated. When that tooth was reseated, the bone area was a little damaged, and it didn't, when it seated itself again, it wasn't quite as straight as it was before. So that's on the dental record. Now, on top of that, you have Lillian Murette saying she paid the dental bill. That gave Lee $20. Now, he stayed away from Dave Ferry, actually joined the Civil Air Patrol again, because he had been started with this one group, and actually got his uniform, and didn't Dave Ferry move over to that one? So he actually encountered him again, and then you see him at that picnic, they call it. But actually, Lee told me that was an intensive training session. These kids were in some kind of survival training thing, and they were very close to these instructors. And of course, Dave Ferry really respected Lee after that, because Lee never told, didn't tell on him. And so in the end, it forged a friendship between them.
Well, that's interesting. You know, a very interesting take on things, because I don't think too many people have really been able to describe the relationship between Lee and David Ferry.
Well, Dave was absolutely brilliant. He knew I could carry on and on about all of that. I wanted to, I know it sounds very improbable, I would like to read something that came in the email just yesterday. A few days ago, excuse me, it is now, but it's from when I have talked about that eventually this was used up at Jackson, and we have the whole record of what really happened, why you have Dave Ferry and you have Clay Shaw involved. By the way, they were not interested in killing Kennedy. They were trying to kill Castro, but they did get in with people who were interested in killing Kennedy, and unfortunately that they didn't have as much protection as the others did, if you want to say it like that. And both Dave Ferry and Clay Shaw really, really had the hammer come down on them when Jim Garrison, who, God bless him, really did his best to try and uncover what was going on. And I believe Garrison was very sincere. I've read some of his comments that he wrote to himself in Dallas. They have in the library there, they have his handwritten notes copied. You can read them. This is a man who sincerely thought he could make a difference, and I'm very glad that he gathered together information. If we didn't have it, I don't know what would happen. But I'd like to read you this Saturday, May 8th, 2004, 7:04 a.m., and this is from William Livesay, L-I-V-E-S-A-Y, and here's what he writes. At Jackson State Hospital, we were put in a large room away from the regular hospital inmates. We were treated well by the orderlies and nurses. I remember being interviewed by one of the staff psychologists. Remember, we had no idea at all what the experiment was about. Most of us volunteered because we were told it would go into our prison records. Now, he had already sent me an email saying that he had been at Angola Prison and had been transferred up here to Jackson. This is exactly what happened with the prisoners that we were involved with also. And I was unable to find any records. This man wrote 4 years ago on a different subject that he had been in Angola, and I wrote to him and just asked him if he could tell me about his experiences while he was in prison. And this is what he wrote back. He says, I was housed at that time in a cell at Angola, and the chance to get better food and more room to move about under less rigid circumstances was enticing. But as I told you earlier, our group was sent right back to Angola after Mays escaped. He sent me an earlier email. So our participation in the medical experiment was minimal. Also, as I mentioned earlier, I was contacted several years later by mail at my home in Miami by Dan Robertson asking if I would testify on his behalf at a civil trial in New Orleans. This was another inmate who was used in this brief experiment. He said, I flew down there and testified for him, and I found out he had died in prison not long afterwards, supposedly under strange circumstances. I do remember that a doctor who was involved in the experiments testified. I was surprised to learn the experiments had been sponsored by Tulane University. And so this is from Bill, and I was glad to get it. I have lots of stuff like this. I would not speak out. I would not talk about these things if I couldn't back it up. I've been trained as a scientist, and I understand the value of documentation.
Judith,
yes.
Is there a time projection for your new book to come out?
It won't be out till at least 2005, and the reason for this is it's a massive book. I'm not kidding when I say I have literally 40 pounds of testimonies, evidence, and things that I saved from 1963. That's why if people come to visit me and see what I have, instead of just, John McAdams has never done such. Before he could spell my name correctly, he was saying I was, a fool and so on. It's a real shame because people like Martin Shackelford, also CBS, 60 Minutes crew, some of them saw all this. A government agent for the CIA who had access to Watergate and Nixon material saw it. He verified my description of the MK Ultra documents that some of which Dave Ferry had. I was able to describe. And things that he had seen that really nobody else has seen.
To ask specific questions then,
yeah.
I guess I wanted to know more that what your impression was of Lee's involvement with, like, David Ferry and Clay Shaw and other impressions you got of what was going on in that time.
Okay, well, when I asked Lee when all this started, he told me that the date was the same as approximately the same as my husband's birthday. And that day was March 23rd, 1962. And if you go to the newspaper, the Times-Picayune, at the time, you'll see I'm reading this right now. It says Fabry is named as the International House Director. Dr. Alton Ochsner, it says here, President, and Fabry will assume his duties April 1st. The executive director post was held for so many years by so-and-so, and then it says he's taking the place of Clay Shaw. Now, Clay Shaw and Ochsner were so close that for 9 years they were running International House together. International House is very closely connected with the International Trademark. And in other words, Ochsner and Clay Shaw were close friends. Ochsner didn't particularly like David Ferry, but Mary Sherman had become friends with him. They met accidentally when Dave was taking toys over to Crippled Children's Hospital, and she was there also distributing toys. It was at Christmas. And they found out that, they just hit it off. She had had some kind of bad experience with her husband in the past. She was a loner. He was a loner. And it's one of the few women that he was able to get along with. He was bisexual. He was not just liking males and all that kind of thing. And I don't mean to insinuate that they had a sexual relationship, but he was down and out. He had lost his job with Eastern Airlines, and he was able to get a little money by referring people to Tulane. Now, Tulane has an extremely important position to play in this because most of our equipment and stuff was filtered through Tulane rather than through Ochsner's clinic. He kept himself separated pretty much from all that. But I have a ton of documentation on the relationships between Ochsner and Inca, and Ochsner going once a week to Washington, D.C., flying to Washington, D.C. He was part of a committee for the Surgeon General there and made reports, and he had CIA clearance and everything.
Okay, well, I just want to back you up a bit because I'm getting a little bit lost. Tulane,
I'm sorry.
Tulane, is that a university or a hospital?
Tulane is a university. It's probably the foremost one involved with Latin American affairs in the United States. going back heaven knows how far, through its medical department. And, of course, it's Ochsner who trained so many South American and Cuban and Mexican people. And it's because Ochsner did have many contacts that were medical in Cuba that he had trained personally, that the CIA felt that they could find a way to use some of these people who were very frustrated because some of them couldn't finish their training. They had to go to Russia instead, and they were angry about it. Now, they kept that a secret from Castro. Castro wouldn't let them come anymore to get finish their training in the United States. And so you had some frustrated people over in Cuba who were in trusted positions in the medical field who nevertheless were anxious to see something happen to Castro so they could go back and get the prestige and the money and the position they would have if they had been under American auspices.